Mr. Speaker.
You're at the intersection of business and politics. This is the 14th and G podcast from Melman Consulting. Now, here's our host, Dean Hinkson.
I'm a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Clemson. Yeah.
What's the title there? Of your class?
I teach the American National Government intro class, and I teach a lot of classes, intro to political theory, constitutional law, law courts and politics, Congress, you name it. As a former Hill staffer, you know, we can kind of do a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. You and I were on the Hill together. You were Senator Toomey's LD, and then you went to run Senate Republican Steering Committee for Senator Lee, right?
That's right. That's right. And you were with Coates for a long time. That's when I interacted with you. But then you were also with the Dole, or maybe?
Yeah, I started with Mrs. Greg. Dole, and then Judd Gregg. You've got a great memory. Elizabeth Dole, Judd Gregg, Dan Coates. And the whole time I was in the Senate, I got to the Senate in 07. I don't know when you got there, but Mitch McConnell's been the majority leader, or the Republican leader, the only one I've known in my time in D.C., and that's coming to an end.
Yeah, it's pretty momentous. It's the end of an era for those of us who worked in the Senate. I got there, I think, in 06 or 07. My memory is not that good. I tend to be selective when it comes to how old I'm getting. But yeah, he's certainly dominated the Senate and the Republican Conference, I think, in a way that a lot of people outside can appreciate.
Yeah, it's a watershed moment. I mean, you know, when I guess, you know, the first big change I noticed in 07, and this was under, Harry Reid was the majority leader at that time for the Democrats. And, you know, they're at the tail end of the Bush administration, but going into the Obama administration, Reid shut the floor down, and in a way that I don't think had been done before. You know, when people talk about, the filibuster gets all the press, but the majority leader's power to fill the tree and essentially dictate the way in which legislation comes to the floor, the way in which it's considered. It's been treated pretty much absolute. And, I think the Reid strategy was to avoid his members taking tough votes. And it was a strategy that paid off. It paid off in 2010, which was a big Republican year for Senate elections. And it paid off in 12. They probably held the majority, at least a Congress longer than they otherwise would have, all but shutting the Senate down.
Yeah. You know, Harry Reid was a remarkable leader. And I say that as a conservative and someone who, you know, battled against Reid in the Senate. But he was able to do things, and he had a skill set, I think, that lent itself very well to that position. But yeah, he was able to get things done in the Senate that, you know, most people couldn't do. But when we think about shutting the floor down, and it had a disastrous, I think, impact on the Senate institutionally. I think we're seeing that now with frustration on both sides. But I've tried to reflect on what happened, because I think the Senate over the past two decades has undergone a greater institutional change than it's ever undergone at any point in its history. And the institution today is almost unrecognizable to what it was when we got there. And I think it's not just, it's not just one side. I think it's both, to be honest with you. Oh. I think I played a role in that as well.
To go around, Coates would tell me, Senator Dan Coates, who I was chief of staff for, you know, he was in the Mitchell Senate in the 90s. George Mitchell was the majority leader, and he would confront a bill that had 200 amendments filed. And Coates would say, Mitchell would say, okay, you want to vote? Let's vote. And, essentially, let the process play out through exhaustion to move legislation. Now, that may be a little apocryphal. People sort of have halcyon views of of days past, but you know, that institutional, that's certainly, the Senate's not been run, that form of regular order has not existed really in the 21st century.
Yeah, and look, the senators would hate it. It takes a lot of effort. I mean, you remember the appropriations season, and I hated appropriations season because we would go to work right on a Monday, and you know, this is going to sound terrible, but you know, we'd work and Wednesday, and the appropriations bills were on the floor for 5 days, except for the defense bill, which would usually be about 2 weeks. And we'd work late Wednesday night till like 3 a.m, maybe 4 a.m. We'd come back on Thursday and we'd work late again. And they'd try to wrap it all up. And if they couldn't, they would come back the next morning, Friday, for a, you know, first thing in the morning, final passage vote. But what going late did was it wore them down. And so you may come into it with, I want to vote on 15 amendments. But at the end, you're like, you know what? I'll just take one. It's even that, because I'm just exhausted and I want to go home.
Right.
And that's what it took to move things through the Senate. But, you know, I think today in our age of partisan polarization, or what we talk about as partisan polarization, you and I both know that up close, the conference and the Republican side, the caucus on the Democratic side, are a lot more divided than what people could appreciate. You know, at the steering committee, one of the things I did was try to, you know, for my bosses, is try to push the conference to the right. And my focus was typically on Republican senators. And what happened was that as these two parties got to be more divided internally, their tolerance for that kind of freewheeling process went down, because, you know, you needed to have the conventional wisdom was you had to have a unified party to raise money, to win elections, to be in the majority. And you didn't get there, or win the White House. You didn't get there by having these ugly, messy floor fights. And so what happened was Reid and McConnell, and before him, Reid and Frist, they would work together, or Daschle and Frist. And increasingly, as the parties got more divided and the temperature went up on the outside, these leaders would work together to try to moderate the process and rein in the outliers, the people like the members I work for. And, you know, when Reid started really shutting the floor down, and this doesn't excuse it by any means, but it was a reaction to the conservatives no longer wanting to go along with this kind of moderated, top-down, you know, leaders, you know, kind of run the show and keep everything in check. So McConnell lost control. And I think the immigration bill in 07 was the first kind of shot across the bow where the leaders lost complete control. And I think one of the lessons was, let's never let that happen again.
Right.
And we began to see the floor get shut down, because that was, you know, and then, you know, so I think conservatives did play a role in that, but obviously it doesn't excuse what Reid did. But I'm more interested these days in trying to understand what happened, as opposed to kind of casting blame.
Well, you've been you've done great work, I think, on trying to remind senators of their prerogatives as United States senators. And so I think of guys like Dave McCormick, Bernie Moreno, Tim Sheehy, newly elected Republican senators who have never held elected office, and they're walking into this storied legislative body, the world's greatest deliberative body, and they're going to be confronted with a leadership structure that says, you know, we're a team. We do, you know, this is how we're going to operate. I don't think Thune, you know, initially at least, is going to be as top down as McConnell. But if you're talking to one of these newly elected senators who've never been in elected office before, and they're confronting this very polarized sort of you know, team fight between Republicans and Democrats, what would you say? How do they exercise not to run counter to the efforts of their conference, but how do they assert themselves as individual senators and exercise the prerogatives that they have on the floor?
Yeah, you know, my style, going back to as a conservative staffer in the Senate, I would routinely, you know, as long as it didn't contradict what my bosses wanted, I typically, and even with my own bosses, but others, I mean, I would, you know, give procedural advice to you know, like a Lisa Murkowski or a Susan Collins, as well as a Pat Toomey or a Mike Lee. And my style was always this is what you can do. These are your options, right? You have a goal that you want, and I wanted to listen to that so I can hear it and then say, okay, how do you achieve that goal? And these are all the things that you can do. Now, it may not make sense to do those things. It may, some may be more appropriate than others in particular circumstances, but I always saw my job both then and now is explaining. And also I talked to Democratic senators as well, but explaining to them in very clear terms that they can understand, this is the awesome power you have. And these are all the different strategies you can use to be effective in that. But I also tell them, these are the costs, right? Because the worst thing you can do is tell somebody, go out and do this. And then they get out there and then they get their head taken off, right? That's like the, you know, they're never going to come back to you again. So I want to empower, senators. But at the same time as I'm empowering them, I also want them to have a realistic understanding of the environment, of that legislative terrain, if you will. And look, you just because you can do things doesn't mean you ought to, or does it make sense? And senators have to make these judgment calls all the time about how hard do I push for what I want? Do I take half a lift now? Do I help out the conference? Do I do something for the institution? But I can't make that decision for them. That's only something they can do. All I can do is help them to get into a place where they finally understand everything, and then they can make it on their own. And I think that kind of advice is unique because, as you know, the second you get to the Senate, regardless of what party you're in, the entire environment is geared towards making you feel like you don't know what you're doing, that you don't have the power you have. And whenever you go to people for advice, they are giving you advice, not in a way that says, hey, let's try to understand this, right? They're giving you advice to get you to an outcome. If the leadership is giving you advice, they're giving you advice to make it more likely that you will do whatever it is they want you to do. If, you know, say the steering committee is doing it, the same thing. Even the parliamentarian does that. Whereas my role, I think, is to say, look, here's all the stuff. And then work through the different pros and cons of all the different approaches so that then they can make that decision without having someone say, this is the outcome you need to get to, right? Because that's not my role as a staffer. It's my role is to help senators understand.
So we've got a new administration coming in. We've you wrote take us back to the election of 1884, James. What similarities do you see? What you wrote a great essay on this. I read recently Grover Cleveland. The election of 1884. And what is a mugwump?
So a mugwump is going to be, you know, this, I love these old things, right? You know, these old sayings, you know, things that, you know, basically, you know, you go back. And one of the things that I do with this piece, and this was in Law and Liberty, is that I try to, when I'm talking to people and I'm trying to reach different audiences, I like to use history, because what I think, what's so great about history is one, that nothing's new. It seems like everything's happened before. But in today's age, when people are very worked up, and they have every right to be worked up, and they're passionate about things, and that's a good thing. You want people to be passionate about politics. But it's hard to kind of get into an issue or help people understand something if you take, say, Trump, right? And this election, which was very kind of devastating for some and joyous for others. So going back to, say, 1884, you get to see a situation where it's very similar, right? So you have mugwumps. They're basically people who are aloof, right? They are independent. They're not party regulars per se. And it basically speaks to the fact that you have these, you know, two different kind of wings of the parties, if you will, in 1884. The parties are divided. Another term you would also often see is dudes and Pharisees, which was another one.
Dudes and Pharisees.
Love. Yeah, it's a biblical reference about the holier than thou people in the party. So the regulars would use that to cast aspersions. But you know, at the end of the day, we have in 1884 Democratic and Republican Party. We have very intense interest in this in the election. We have broad dissatisfaction with the tops of the ticket. We have a victor, Grover Cleveland, right, who ultimately wins by kind of scrambling the coalition, scrambling kind of where people were and who they voted for. And there's a lot of similarity to this election. One, Trump, like Cleveland, is the only other president to serve two non-consecutive terms in the White House. But I think the reason why is, I think, more important, because if you saw what happened with Trump's coalition, it's not a normal Republican coalition by any means, right? And I think you see, and that's directly related to the fact that these parties are divided, and there's so much churn happening below the surface in American politics that but we can't appreciate that because we are almost, you know, hardwired these days to think in terms of a red America and a blue America, of these immovable coalitions, of polarization, right? And to a certain extent, that's all there. But if you scratch the surface and you look underneath, there's very little that people agree on. And the coalitions backing the parties are changing immensely.
Immensely.
And, and trying to get people to appreciate that and not come into it as a, I love Trump or I hate Trump, right? That's not, you know, that people can do that. That's all, more power to them. But to truly appreciate what happened or what the election signaled about our American electorate and American politics moving forward, I think we need to kind of step back from that. And that's why I think this historical look is a very helpful mechanism to get people to do that.
You know, you think of things like Karl Rove's permanent majority. You know, every, you know, you've got, you know, Republicans have been in the wilderness after 08. Democrats are in the wilderness today. These coalitions are not permanent. These trips out into the wilderness are never permanent. But you're right. Like we've been talking about party realignment. This election, to me, this is realignment is here. You're starting to see the crumble of particularly with the minority voter coalition for Democrats. You know, they're never likely to see 95% of the black vote again. It's just a different day on so many fronts, and you know that seems to me the first challenge. You know, particularly for Republicans and Trump and whoever's going to be next, is how they hold that coalition together, or create a new coalition that's going to be effective for them.
Yeah, you know, the whole idea of a permanent majority is completely nonsensical in American politics. You know, James Madison tells us in Federalist 10 that you can't even have a temporary majority on a national basis on every single issue, right? That the majorities, what people want, ultimately emerges out of that process, the give and take of politics, of arguing with one another. That's how you get it, because we're so diverse that you can't, you know, the country is so big with so many people and so many interests that the idea that the Republican or Democratic Party could represent a consistent and stable majority for a prolonged period of time, much less permanent period of time, is nonsensical. And last time I checked, a permanent majority is just another word for a ruler, right? I mean, a majority of the people can rule just as well as one person can rule. And we don't have rulers in America. And I think that what we've lost sight of, and look, we're to, you know, my kind of academic, you know, world is to blame. The commentary world is to blame for this as well, because we are tasked with trying to help people make sense of politics. So what do? We tell them it's like you're building a table, right? We're just constructing this thing. We know what to do, right? You get these experts and you have demographics as destiny and the black vote's going to vote for Democrats. Well, yeah, but, you know, at the end of the day, minority groups are individual voters. And right. What you see right now are, you know, the whole notion of like, oh, well, when America becomes a majority minority country, that's going to be this. And I'm like, that, you know, white people are individual people just as much as like a Hispanic American. You have an individual, and that individual is going to make decisions that you're going to be influenced, of course, by their life experiences and who they are, et cetera. But they're still an individual. And when we write the individual out of politics, we ultimately lose sight of the potential in politics and also where it can go. But, you know, last thing I'll say on that is, if you look at France right now, you have a situation in France where the far right and the far left are joining forces together to force a vote of no confidence over the kind of the center, ultimately trying to push through a budget without having the kind of full process where people get to weigh in and say what they think on what's on their mind. Right. So this is a bizarre world where the far right and the far left can kind of join together. And they're both joining together and saying that this budget doesn't do enough for the working man. Right. Which just sounds very similar. And we have a situation now where Trump is apparently, we're told, the leader of a reactionary party of white voters who are upset that they're going to be a minority in this country. But he's also diversifying at the same time. Right. If we take that at face value, which I don't agree with, but if we take it at face value, at the same time, he is diversifying the Republican Party. That doesn't make sense with these conventional lenses that we use to make sense of politics. So if you're a business, if you are a voter who's concerned about issues, if you are a student, it doesn't matter who you are. If you want to understand what's next in the next chapter of American politics, you got to get rid of these kind of orthodoxies. And you need to look at things with a fresh eye and say, what do people want? What are the struggles that they face on a daily basis? And how is that influencing their decision on who to vote for in individual elections? Not, oh, that's a Republican. Right. That's a Democrat. That tells us absolutely nothing, in my opinion.
It's a coalition that's, I think, you know, we've seen, you know, the number of change elections, you know, in the post-World War II period. I mean, every 2 years is a change election, whether it's House, Senate, or White House. We're just in that era, and these coalitions are up for grabs every 2 years. And you're so right. We Republicans and Democrats have got to get out of this orthodoxy mindset of, you know, this is the way things are, and our voters will always come home because we've got the red or the blue branding beside our name. But this is a reset. This is a reset on a lot of levels. We've talked about the end of the McConnell era in the Senate. Senator Thune is assuming the majority leader position in the new Congress. He's going to have a lot to prove to his caucus. And I thought it was really interesting that I think the first marker he laid down was to the Senate on nominations. You know, I think it was the day after the election or the day after that when we started hearing all of this talk about the president's power to make recess appointments, the president's power to adjourn the Congress and create a recess and sort of softening up like, hey, guys, I'm not waiting around. I'm not waiting around for you to do your Senate thing and get me the people that I want. I'm sort of, you know, I'm diving into more esoteric areas of the president's powers, you know, everything's sort of on the table. And so I thought that was an interesting way to begin, because it was not what I think I expected was more of a frontal assault on the filibuster. What do you make of that? Where Trump is going, putting Senate Republicans on notice? You know, what is his power to make these recess appointments, and how do you see it playing out as leverage in the confirmation process?
Yeah, and the filibuster is going to be an issue when there's a big push on a legislative proposal that divides the parties right down the middle, right down, you know, Republican and Democrat. And until then, I don't think it's not going to really manifest itself. And it may not if we don't ever have that fight either. But the confirmation stuff is all front loaded in a new administration. So it makes sense that this is bubbling up now. And I think Trump is frustrated with the Senate, but also with Republicans. You know, since we've gotten rid of the ability to debate judges for a prolonged period and executive branch officials with the nuclear option and nuking the filibuster, you can just have a vote on a judge or a presidential appointee whenever you want if you're in the majority. And what happened, though, was that even despite this, the two leaders used the nominations as a way to kind of keep people around, and they negotiate amongst themselves. And they say, we're going to have a bed check vote on a Monday night. We'll have a Thursday afternoon vote. We'll have a vote in the middle of the week on a Wednesday. And they kind of parcel them out. And then they agree. The Republicans were agreeing to unanimous consent requests by the Democrats to let the time after you invoke cloture on a nominee run overnight, prolonging it, right? It's not a floor, it's a ceiling, right? You can go up to that. You don't have to. And I think that Trump was very frustrated with the pace and how aggressively Republicans were pushing these nominees through early in his administration. And I think this is a reaction to that. You know, as far as the substance of what he's kind of threatened to do, and I think it is kind of a threat. I mean, that's what Trump He's a businessman, and this is kind of like, you're like, if you don't do this, I'm going to do this. And what he proposed at first, this idea of recess appointments, that's, it's completely legitimate, right? There's two ways to get a job in the federal government that's appointed, right? You can go through the regular process of advise and consent, where the president nominates and the Senate has an independent role to play on whether to approve that nomination. And if they do, then that person has that job, right? There's another way, and this is because the Senate wasn't always around for long periods of time, and the government still needed to kind of function until the Senate got back and could have an opportunity to pass judgment. And so the president can make what we call a recess appointment, which is an appointment that only serves a very limited period of time. Now, there, you have to have a recess, though, for this to happen, which means that because the Senate and the House can't adjourn without each other's permission for more than 3 days, and you have to, according to the Supreme Court, be out for at least 10 to make a recess appointment, you need the House and Senate to recess. So Trump called on the Senate to recess, and presumably he could get this, the House, to go along with it. There's nothing, you know, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, there's nothing inherently, you know, unconstitutional or wrong about that, right? It's a power the president has, and it's the power the Senate has to decide when to adjourn. What things started to get a little kind of, you know, a little like, all, you know, a little like out of alignment, I think, and started to kind of strain the Constitution, if not outright break it, is when the president suggested, or not the president, but allies of to the president, suggest that the president can work with the House to somehow forcibly adjourn the Senate. And they cited a provision that's never been used in the Constitution that says that the president can adjourn the House and Senate when there is a disagreement between the two bodies over the time of their adjournment. And so the idea was that the House could pass an adjournment resolution, and if the Senate didn't act on it, that would constitute a disagreement, and then the president could forcibly adjourn the Senate. And that is a radical departure from both the norms, but also from the text of the Constitution and the history of this, and also how the Senate operates as a body.
What, well, James, what's the history there? I frankly, I think this is Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution. You'll correct me if I've got that wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the recess appointment power.
That's the recess appointment power.
But no, look.
Article 1, Section 6 is the gives the president the power to adjourn the Congress. Do you know what was the original thinking there in when the House and Senate disagree on recessing, the president, almost like a king, you know, the king had the power to dissolve the parliament, has the power to adjourn the Congress. It's never been used. What was the thinking, do you know, by the founders?
So this is one of those areas where the Constitution kind of, you know, how it comes together, in the end, it doesn't always add up. Look, from the colonial period, we know, you know, one thing's very clear. American patriots were very upset with the Parliament and the Crown for forcibly shuttering and dissolving the Massachusetts colonial legislature with the Intolerable Acts. They called them the Coercive Acts. That rallied Americans around the cause of independence in a way that hadn't been done before. We know that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison were very upset with the royal governor in Virginia for shuttering their assembly, the House of Burgesses. They all met. This is when Madison and Jefferson meet for the first time in the tavern in Colonial Williamsburg. You can go and have like a lunch there now with the, you know, kind of the park they have set up, right? So this is something that they react to very aggressively. And it's in the Declaration. One of the long historical kind of abuses that they cite is the Parliament and the King, the Crown, shuttering their assemblies. So the idea that they want to give this power to an executive right off the bat just doesn't square with our historical kind of birth as a nation. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, the power itself was only lodged. And if you look at the state constitutions, most of the state constitutions have this power. They gave it to the governor. But what is interesting about the first state constitutions is that they took a lot of power from the governor, they lodged it in the assembly, and then they made the governor dependent on the assembly to the point where the assemblies, for the most part, picked the governor in almost all of the states, right? And the governor was a very weak position. And so the idea was that if the House and Senate in the, say, a state legislature disagreed as to the time, then the governor being could help resolve that disagreement, but it wouldn't pose a threat because they picked the governor. Then we fast forward to the Constitutional Convention and in 1787, that hot, sticky summer. And ultimately what happened was up until the very end of the convention, the very end, the Congress picked the president, right? And it's only at the very end of the convention where they shift to the Electoral College. But when they make that shift, this other provision, which is completely consistent with the state constitutions, completely consistent with everything in kind of our founding, it still stays in there, right? And so all of a sudden, now you have a situation where a president picked by Electoral College, not by Congress, has this power to adjourn Congress, but again, only when they disagree. And as you know, there is that's a very specific thing, right? And you know, you have to first, if you want to disagree as to the time of adjournment, that means that the House and Senate have to have an opinion as to the time of adjournment. The only way they can have an opinion, because they're a body of a lot of different people, is if they take action on the House and Senate floor that constitutes them saying this is our opinion. And that's so basically, if the Senate never does that, there's no disagreement, right? And we have motions in the Senate. There's a motion in the conference process and the amendment exchange process between the chambers to disagree, right? That like you have to disagree before you can go to a conference committee.
So if right? there is a this normally is done, and I don't remember the last time the Congress adjourned sine die. Because they, you know, the Senate keeps a the Senate keeps a pro forma session going for the express purpose of preventing recess appointments. But this typically would come about by a joint resolution. So, if the House passed a joint resolution to adjourn on a date certain, and the Senate just never took it up, there wouldn't be disagreement.
Correct. I mean, think about it. If there was. Then we have to take this. It's just common sense. Like you don't need to be an expert in Senate procedure to figure this out. Okay, if inaction constitutes disagreement, well, how long? Is it a day? Is it a month? Is it a week? Is it an hour? Right? At what point does inaction become disagreement? And also, the Constitution very clearly, in Article 1, Section 5, Clause 2, gives the House and Senate the power to order their own proceedings. They get to decide whatever they want as long as it doesn't flagrantly violate or doesn't violate another constitutional provision. So they can't change their like the age requirement to be in the House and Senate. But they can do whatever they want. And they are the only branch that has that power. The Supreme Court doesn't have it. The executive doesn't have it, but they do. Right. So if we now say that the Senate has to dispose of this and we have to give a time, right? If inaction constitutes, you know, in a disagreement, there has to be a time associated with that. Otherwise, it's instantaneous, which means that the Senate doesn't even exist. And so at that point, when we have a time, what we're doing is we're telling the Senate how to order its own proceedings. The president has no authority to do that, and neither does the House. For this to work, what would have to happen is that the House would take a concurrent resolution. It's not signed into law. It never goes to the president. And the House passes it. It says, we're going to adjourn until for 20 days or to this date. The Senate takes up that that resolution, and the Senate debates it, and then the Senate says we're going to change it, and we're going to say we're going to adjourn for 5 days instead of to 20 days, right? And then they vote for that change, and then they vote to send the resolution back to the House. Only when the House picks up that resolution and then decides that it doesn't agree with it and votes to disagree, that's when a state of disagreement exists. It does not exist at any other point until then. To go to a conference, what you have to do is that basically you have to have a bill come from the House, go to the Senate. The Senate changes the bill, sends it back to the House. The House can take the Senate bill. They're not in disagreement yet. The House may decide they want to do that. It's only when the House votes to reject the Senate or the Senate votes to reject the House changes that they are in a state of disagreement. And in the Senate, we actually have motions for that, too. You vote to reject and you say, we disagree. And then you can vote to request a conference. You can vote to change it further or to insist on yours and send it back to the House. But that's the state of disagreement. It's not just inaction.
Fascinating. Just going back to the other part of the recess appointment power, you noted the Supreme Court has weighed in on this in the Noel Canning decision, to specify 10 days to create a recess sufficient to make a recess appointment. There's also a statute out there, the Federal Vacancies Reform Act of 1998. How does that play into the process?
Well, the idea here is with a recess appointment, if you're able to make one, it's time limited, right? It's only going to last until the end of the session, right? The next session. And so basically, if you want someone to be in office for a longer period of time, and presumably that would be like a cabinet official, right? You need to figure out how to deal with that. And if you are blatantly going around the Senate and circumventing the advice and consent role, using the recess appointment power, which again is a constitutional power, the president can do it. But there are consequences of using your power in a way that the other branches don't like. Right, they can retaliate. And one way they can retaliate is to say, we're not going to confirm your nominee when we come back in session. So basically, you have this this statute that allows you to basically say time served in the various positions creates or counts. It makes you eligible to be acting. And it's a way to prolong a recess appointment, or at least that's the idea. It's a way to prolong that appointment. Now, of course, the Senate and the House can retaliate against that. They can cut off the salary. I know that there's been talk about this being unconstitutional, that the House and Senate somehow can't restrict funding for someone because of the president has this right, somehow this inherent right to pay a salary to someone. But the Constitution is also very clear on this. It doesn't matter what any previous law says, because Constitution trumps the law. And the Constitution says very clearly that no money shall leave the Treasury unless the House approves. That means if the House does nothing, it doesn't even have to vote to say no. It just has to do nothing, right? It can just not fund something. And if it doesn't fund something, and this is one of the most fundamental kind of parts of our kind of political DNA, the executive can't just go and take money out of the Treasury. This goes back to the Magna Carta. Right. And so you can't if the House and Senate decide that they don't like what the president's doing with using recess appointments, then converting them to acting appointments afterwards, they have the power of the purse, which James Madison said is the most effectual power that a free people can give their representatives to resist tyranny. Right. It's Federalist 58. And so that power is unqualified. They get to choose how to use it, just like the president can choose how to use his recess appointment power. There are restrictions, of course, it has to be in a recess. There's restrictions to the House. The Senate has to agree, right? We have two Congresses, the House and the Senate. So the way they use these powers are going to have limits, but the powers themselves are not limited, right? And only the president and only the House and Senate get to decide how they want to use their powers under the Constitution. If they didn't, then it would be the president's in charge, or it'd be the Congress is in charge. And the separation of powers is very clear. No one is in charge. That also goes for the Supreme Court. The only thing that these branches get to do is decide for themselves in executing their own powers what is and is not constitutional. But they can't tell somebody else how to use their powers. Then wouldn't be a separation of powers. It would be that person would be ruling.
James, let's take a look at the flip side of that question. Our old friend Russ Vaught is headed back to run the Office of Management Budget, the OMB, in the White House, which has enormous influence over federal spending and departmental management within the executive branch. If you haven't listened to it, and I commend it to my audience as well, he did a podcast with Tucker Carlson, in which he articulated, I think, in great detail, his and the incoming administration's views on some of these federal spending questions. And one of the big theories out there, and I'm curious your take, is the power of impoundment. The idea, and I'm probably oversimplifying here, but the idea that congressionally appropriated spending, when it gets to the executive branch, is a ceiling and not a floor, that the executive branch can take that appropriated funding, it can spend all of it, it can spend half of it, it can spend none of it for its congressionally directed purpose. How do you, have you given, have you heard this? Have you given it any thought? I mean, I think it's a theory that's going to be tested out in the early going here, that that really the executive branch has an enormous amount of control. It's essentially a line item veto within the executive branch.
Yeah, like I know Russ well. He's very smart and very talented, and you know he's got a big job. This will be the second time he's had this job. And what I would encourage people to do is to not think about these things as kind of open and shut. And that may sound odd coming from me, because I've typically going to be very aggressive in defending congressional prerogatives. But yeah, I don't. In an open and shut sense, I think it's the Congress gets to decide how to spend the money, right? And the executive then implements that. But there are lots of wrinkles to this, right? One of them is, what does the law say? Right? There's so many things in statute that give the executive discretion, that give the president and departments discretion in various ways in terms of entering into contracts, right? In formulating regulations. So you may have an appropriation, but that appropriation is just giving to a department a pot of money. And then they use that pot of money to implement a grant program that has been authorized by law somewhere. But that grant program that was authorized by law may give those the department, the regulators, the ability to go in and decide, okay, well, how are we going to do it? And then they propound regulations to ultimately determine how they're going to do it. And so a lot of this has been Congress handing over a lot of their kind of role to the executive branch, especially in very technical areas. And so are there ways that the president can, via his control of this hierarchical organization, which is the executive branch, change regulations through the Administrative Procedures Act? Can they, do they have discretion under the law in some places to do things that may amount to them not spending as much on something? I'm sure that's out there, right? I'm sure that's out there. But does that mean that it's just a matter of principle that the president can just decide to not do something that Congress says? Of course not. And if Congress doesn't like this, right? If Congress doesn't like what the president's doing, then Congress has tools to change that, right? They can put funding riders in appropriations bills. They can pass new laws. They can impeach. They can impeach Russ. They can impeach the president and everybody on down if they don't like it. Now everybody's going to say, well, that's going to be a higher hurdle, a two-thirds. Well, that doesn't mean they can't do it. It just means it's hard, right? So I think our system is set up to make sure that what makes our system work is that give and take between the branches. And ultimately, Congress has given, the president has a lot of leeway on a lot of things. Now, again, I don't think it amounts to this open and shut, I can impound funds, period, full stop. But when you look into the details, I think we'd all be really surprised by what Congress has ultimately kind of given away to the executive. And the answer to that is not to say, there's just this flat out principle and to ignore all of those details. I think the answer to that is to say, if we like the way that this is set up, then we need to use other tools at our disposal to make sure that the president doesn't abuse the power that we've given him. And if we don't like the way it's set up, because the president is abusing that power, in our opinion, then the answer is to take that power back, right? And I think what I find with a lot of these debates is, does the president have the ability to impound funds or not? Well, I mean, that might be beside the point, right? I don't think the president has the ability to impound funds as a principle, the principle of the matter. But again, there are a lot of details below the surface. And as you and I both know, when you get into this, it's like, whoa, that's not as simple as we ultimately thought.
Yeah. That big sort of begs the question, the biggest sort of shift in executive deference we've seen was the end of Chevron. In a Supreme Court opinion this year. The name of that case eludes me. It ended Chevron defense.
Well, now I've forgot. It's the one that ended Chevron defense. I think we could just call it that.
Let's call it that. But so how do you see, how does that play into it? It seems, if Congress doesn't do anything here to write more detailed regulations and laws It seems to me it just empowers the courts, and it's sort of a missed opportunity by Congress if they don't get in the game, essentially, in the regulatory space. I mean, you would probably say it's always been within Congress's power to write very detailed regulations and take some of this authority back from what a lot of people on our side of the aisle call the fourth branch of government, the regulatory agencies. But does that play into these spending, into the sort of these spending fights we're going to have? Do you think Congress will take up this opportunity and get more into the game of what the agencies have been left to do?
Look, I mean, for anybody who's read Huckleberry Finn, right? You every time you see a steamboat in that book, or you read a steamboat, it's like bad things are happening. It's on fire. It's underwater. People are their bodies floating in the water, right? And this is one of the first areas that we started to regulate were steamboats on the Mississippi River, right? And so I don't, you know, I think the question isn't whether there is a regulatory state or not. The question, you know, I think the question ought to be, what is Congress's role in ensuring kind of democratic accountability and oversight of that regulatory state, that administrative state, right? What the Chevron case did was essentially say, prior to this case, the original Chevron case, it was basically said, look, you know, that we're going to give some deference. We're going to executive branch agencies when they kind of try to understand what Congress intended and when they make these regulations. And this case reversed that and said, we're no longer going to just presumptively, you know, defer. But I think that the Chevron case in many respects is over, the one that overturned Chevron is overstated the effects in many cases. One, because the courts are going to defer to the regulators on very technical issues. You know, that's just something that they are going to do, right? Just because a judge has the options to not do that now under in one of the kind of in the inferior courts of the district and appellate courts, doesn't mean that they're not, you know, going to use it per se. And then also, as you said, this doesn't inevitably shift power back to Congress. Congress is the one who is deferring to the executive branch in the first place,
right?
And only Congress, the court can't force Congress to do its job. Only Congress can do that. Now, again, I think, does that mean that Congress is now going to be writing? I mean, regulations are massive. They're so much longer than the bills that authorize them. And they go into the weeds in a way that it's maybe very difficult to do in the legislative branch, right? So I think what we need to avoid is recreating an executive branch in the legislative branch, because that's not their job, right? Their job is to adjudicate our concerns, negotiate the non-negotiable, and ultimately be the place where we govern ourselves. It's not to be, you know, designing kind of like the asphalt standards for federal highways, right? That's not what it does. And so, you know, if we, maybe they should pass, and they probably should pass, I think, you know, I would say more detailed legislation, but there is going to be a role, especially in our day and age with like spectrum auctions and things like that, where the legislators are not equipped. And if they were equipped, then they would no longer be representing us. They'd be bureaucrats, right? So it's not, can the administrative state be transferred to the Congress? I think the better question is, how do we make sure that Congress can continue to oversee the administrative state and ensure that the administrative state works for the American people and not for the president, or not for, you know, kind of unaccountable bureaucrats in the executive branch? And I think that's the one. I mean, we had at the first Trump administration, we're going to destroy the administrative state is what we heard a lot of. And I'm like, well, but that's not going to happen, right? And it's not realistic, because then if it did, then either we would not have, you know, we wouldn't be regulating steamboats anymore, which I don't think is going to happen. And then also it would mean that Congress is doing it. And that would mean that Congress isn't doing its other job, its big job, which is to be a Congress, to represent us.
Loper Bright is the answer we were looking for. Loper Bright.
I mean, I've written on this. I should, my memory is a little bit foggy.
Loper Bright Enterprises. Yeah. Well, James, imagine my surprise this past summer when I was flipping through my latest issue of The New Yorker, and I saw you, my old friend, quoted in a story, not a place I expected to see a James Wallner quote in the New Yorker. It was a really interesting story about you know, this sort of the third party groups that have formed in and around, you know, for lack of a better term, Trump world. You were part of the Heritage Foundation when you left the Hill and Heritage Action. I'm just curious, you know, to me, it seems, you know, I think if, of the many, sources of regret, for Democrats and the way they've conducted themselves, over the last decade or so, I think one of their great sources of regret is going to be the fact that they gave Trump 4 years in the wilderness. And this sort of, you know, there's Heritage Action, there's the America First Policy Institute. This really sort of, you know, I've told my clients, like, if you want to know their thinking, it's all right there. You know, it's a very articulated view of some of these questions, like impoundment and others, but a very articulated worldview on foreign policy, on economic issues. And, you know, they have not, he didn't just go away for 4 years. There was an administration in exile that was preparing for a return. How do you see, I mean, obviously we're seeing, you know, we're seeing some of these nominees come out of these places, you know, some of these think tanks and others. But how do you see this sort of, I can't think of another president who sort of had this enormous outside of government apparatus of think tanks that are not only with him ideologically, but, you know, are really personally aligned with Trump. How do you see that influence? Is it and how do you see it playing out?
Well, you know, I think we've seen in the past that think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute or even Brookings have been places where kind of cabinet officials and others go when administration change, party change happens. I think what's different about this is not just the coordinated aspect of it per se, even if just informally, but how it created an entirely new infrastructure. And this article in the New Yorker you referenced is written by a guy named Jonathan Blitzer, who is just an eminently, you know, fair guy in the conversations we had. You know, what struck me about him was he was trying to understand, and the article, you know, started out as an effort to understand Jim DeMint and what he had created at the CPI, the Conservative Partnership Institute, which is the organization he started after leaving Heritage. And so that's how we talked. I mean, I think the article ultimately ended up about the Trump world writ large. Mm-hmm. But that environment really is a creature of, I think, the genius of Jim DeMint. And what I mean by that is DeMint is, he's a convener. He takes seriously what we used to say at Heritage, but he actually lived it. The idea of, he wants to grow a movement by addition and multiplication, right? Not subtraction and division. And so the idea is, instead of, you know, bringing people into CPI, it's like, let's figure out how to help them start their own organizations and then help them and try to coordinate with them and bring them together and then create a space for both the, you know, these organizations, for members, for staff, for former administration officials to kind of come together. And this is a really unique thing. And, you know, and in the article, is, you know, to my knowledge, at least in talking to Jonathan, was that it was basically looking at that, which is a relatively new thing, that kind of approach to politics. But I do think we're going to see it. You will see it replicated on the left. Look, the conservatives in the Senate learned from the progressives in the House in the 1950s, right? The Democratic Study Group. And then you see the conservatives in the House and Senate in the 70s start to replicate a lot of that stuff. The Heritage Foundation comes on the scene in the 70s. And almost overnight, it revolutionizes the think tank space. And now we have Center for American Progress. We have a lot of other organizations on the left that are now kind of mimicking and trying to model themselves on Heritage and how it raises money, how it designs its products, how it reaches its audience. What does it have a grassroots kind of, or not grassroots, but does it have like a C4? associated with it. Like the think tank world, even Brookings, they've all kind of moved in the direction of heritage, not necessarily on policy, of course not, but in terms of how they how you are a think tank, how you do that job. And I think what we'll see is, in the same way, what Dement has done, which is, I think, and Dement is he's one of the most consequential figures, I think, in American political history in the last, you know, two decades or so. And I think that in the end, a lot of what we've seen, at least in terms of the conservative movement, he's not the only one by any means, of course not. But what he was, I think, one of the critical figures in that allowed that kind of web of organizations and the people and talent of meshing of ideas to kind of form, because this is formed outside of the Republican Party. Because this is a, you know, we speak of realignments. I mean, this, you know, they don't all agree on everything, of course, but in general, on foreign policy, it's a very different kind of foreign policy than what we were used to when we came up in the ranks of the Republican Party, right? When we first got started, very different on trade policy. Yep. Immigration has been a flashpoint in the party for a very long time on all of these issues. So they had to recreate a new infrastructure to further their policy goals on these issues. And the way they went about doing that, I think, is something that is very innovative. And I think because of that, you're going to see it replicated on the left at some point. It's just a matter of time.
It's such a great point, James. I really wish there are so many people that that came of age in the Republican Party when we did. And, you know, that Republican Party, that era of the party is over, and it's not coming back. And I really urge, you know, I really urge our friends with with conservative leanings, who have worked in the Republican Party, to recognize that I think that this party under Trump, this administration, is trying to be responsive to the way America is today and the way America is developing in the 21st century, that, you know, a lot of the Depression era and post-World War II institutions, there's a lot of good in there, but there's a lot of things that need to change. And, you know, the dynamism, while uncomfortable, is really necessary. Because we don't live in, we don't, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, I think probably like you may be a little younger than me, but it was in so many ways a completely different world. And we need new ideas, new thoughts, and we need to reorder our institutions in a way that serves people now, not the way we want the world to return to. And I'm excited. So I appreciate your thoughts on all this.
Yeah, no, like, I think you have more hair than I do, so I don't know how, you know, I'll take it that. But like, you know, I think that the essence of being a conservative, at least as I understand it, is a constant kind of engagement with the past and trying to say, what is it about the past or the tradition, as I would say, that we want to keep that's good, right? What do we want to preserve?
Conserve,
yeah. Right? And then you say, well, what's all the bad stuff that we don't want to get? We don't want to keep, right? Let's get rid of that. That's not a good thing, right? And let's then jettison that. But then the third category is the really hard one. It's like, what is it about our tradition or our past or what we've done that we want to keep, but we need to change in some way? And this is a very uncomfortable kind of thought process. It's one that people typically, maybe if you have like a financial planner, they make you do this kind of thing. Or if you go to, like, you know, in church or something like that. I mean, it's a hard thing and to be kind of reflective in this way and honest with yourself. And God knows I fall short all the time, but it's, you know, to strive to do that. I think that's important. And we need to have that kind of assumption of humility. And also that we can make it better, I think, moving forward, but not in a progressive sense of like the past doesn't matter. Right. I think that's important, but I think more also important is to look at our institutions not as factories that produce outcomes, that we have somehow figured it all out. And this is what is, the institutions are places where we go to have these arguments. And I think too often what we saw in the Senate when we were there, when people would challenge something on, say, trade policy, or they would challenge immigration policy that George Bush wanted, and Conference of Immigration, whatever it may be, if you suggested somehow that maybe let's not get involved in a war in Afghanistan or something. You know, if whatever it may be, you were greeted with a, you know, Jeff Flake, who, you know, was there when we were there, and he is a very sincere guy, and he's very deeply passionate and principled. But he basically would take policy disagreements, and then he would raise them. He wrote a book about this, and he would say, you are violating our kind of civic heritage and the principles of America on things like foreign policy and trade policy and immigration. And I'm sitting here scratching my head thinking, well, you know, when the Republican Party started, it was a protectionist party that had a more humble approach to foreign policy, and it was hawkish on immigration, right? And then it changed. And whether or not those are the right decisions, that's for other people to decide. But I think too often what we see in our debates today, and especially the reaction to Trump in particular, is a, you know, you can't have that view. That view is dangerous, right? Versus a, what is the right trade policy, right? Because I can tell you what we have now is also not free trade. It's just the, there are rules, right? I mean, it's not like unfettered free trade. It's like that we have certain rules. And then the question is, should those rules be more protective, or should they be less protective, or should we change them? And all of a sudden, or, you know, foreign policy, if you say maybe let's not do something, it's like all of a sudden now you're an isolationist,
right?
You know, if you, you know, this also exists between the parties. If you have a question about voter ID, you are not, it's, you're a racist, right? You're told you're racist. And it's like, well, that just shuts the conversation down, right? Maybe it's not a good idea what you want to do. Maybe it is. Maybe most likely it's a little bit of both. Right. And it's that process and that arguing in these institutions over what is the proper foreign policy. Like, look, you know, is it, you know, things change over time. And it may be that we need to be more involved or less involved in foreign policy. But that is an open question that is legitimate to ask. And it is a, and it is the appropriate place. The appropriate place to ask that is in Congress, is in politics. But too often what we have are the kind of the parts of the parties, and I think this is on both sides, that have seen the American people kind of shift in a way that they're not comfortable with, have basically said that this is dangerous, that this is going to destroy America in some way, that this is a threat to, you know, whatever it may be. And when you start saying that certain policy outcomes, however good those policy outcomes may be, when those policy outcomes become the end and anything that disagrees with them is somehow dangerous, then we're not really doing self-government anymore. We're basically, you know, being ruled by whoever gets to decide what the policy outcome, the appropriate policy outcome is. And so I think what I would like to see is more people in the arena arguing over these outcomes, as opposed to saying, how dare you bring this up? You're an isolationist. That's not a good thing. Tell me why we should be involved in overseas in a war, right? Or we shouldn't be involved. But let's get specific about it. And then the American people can hold them, they can hold them accountable.
And it's no, to me, it's no coincidence that we're having, you know, we're finally at a point of enormous realignment. I think we're on the cusp of enormous change. I think the 119th Congress is poised to be one of the most consequential and transformational Congresses we've had in the post-World War II period. And it's no, to me, it's no coincidence that the ability of the establishments of both parties to control the narrative, you know, through legacy media, through the Washington Post and the New York Times, you know, the ability to set the narrative is really for the first time in the post-World War II modern media age is being challenged. And you do have so many more voices, you know, through podcasts, through, you know, through social media and all the rest of the channels that we're familiar with, of people, asking, just, you know, it's asking the questions is such a good point, James. It's, you know, it, that's dangerous. Those are dangerous questions. Well, you know, $300 billion to Ukraine, God bless them, but, you know, people can't ask the question. And, you know, the ability of people to break through with those questions and to demand, you know, demand the rationale, like you said, defend it, articulate your worldview other than this is dangerous. Don't worry about it.
Right. You know, in the Senate, I would often, I'd be the guy who would ask these questions. I remember one, we had a meeting and it was like about tax reform. And the way we talk about tax reform as conservative Republicans was like, it was clear cut, open and shut. But we were having this argument about the way that we were describing, at least in this room, the some Democratic effort to, raise the top marginal tax rate by like 2 percentage points. I'm like, wait a minute. Is the difference between 37 and 39% of top marginal tax rate really the difference between like a communist and like a freedom-loving American? Give me a break. Now, it may be a bad idea to have it at 39%. I would prefer it not to be, whatever it was at the time. But the way that we were talking about it was like, this is just absurd. We're just like, we're just like a little less communist than them. If like a 39% is a com like what? It doesn't make any sense. What I would encourage your listeners to think about this too, because it is scary. It is scary to wake up and realize that the world is in flux, that there are consequential things that you care deeply about, that are happening, that if they don't go the way you want, that it's all gonna, it's gonna be really bad. And now
The
you've got
end
to
of
let the person who
democracy.
wants to do the opposite of what you want to have a say and maybe potentially win. Oh my God, that's terrifying. I get it. But what I would say is, at the end of the day, if you look at periods in American political history when things were in flux and people were upset and the system wasn't responding, right? We have some of the most insanely productive periods in American history. I don't say that in a production is just important, like how many bills you pass. No, but look, if you look at the 60s and the early 70s, for instance, in this country, now, I don't, at the end of the day, I don't like, I mean, they did a lot of incredible stuff. A lot of some stuff people may like, some stuff people may not like. But as a fact of the matter, the amount of stuff that the Congress was able to do, the issues they tackled, the things they did, the landmark legislation they passed, the debates they had, it was incredible. And they did it at a time when they're like, it was a freewheeling open floor. I mean, it was like no holds barred in the Senate, especially, right? And then everybody's pissed off. The left's pissed off. The right's pissed off. Everybody's in the streets. You have the civil rights movement happening. You have in the end of the 60s, our cities are literally on fire. We're in Vietnam. The CIA is trying to kill God knows who overseas, right? Where they're spying on Americans. You got Hoover doing who knows what at the FBI, right? Spying on the civil rights leaders, spying on other people, but using the FBI apparatus, like, nothing's new under the sun, the threats that we're told today.
So
But
true.
in all this stuff, we have the National Guard shooting students at Kent State in the early 70s. This country was literally coming apart at the seams. And amidst all of this, we have assassinations like JFK and RFK, Malcolm X, Dr. King, right? All of this stuff is happening. We have the Soviet Union and American dominance seems to be fading, right? It is unbelievable how much stuff we were able to do amidst all of that. And it's almost as if despite those disagreements, we did great things. And this is time and again, whenever we see Congress at its height, it's precisely in those types of periods, like the pre-Civil War antebellum era as well. And I think that's because the compromise, the things that we are able to then transcend our own narrow perceptions and get a better sense of reality in the round, that comes about through struggle. It comes about through people trying to do things and disagreeing. You can't get a compromise unless you first disagree. And I think what's encouraging about American history is that even in the most intense moments where things seemed like they are their most dire, we turn to politics. Some turn to violence, but we, for the most part, thankfully, turn to politics, which is the only other way to make a collective decision. And we debate each other aggressively, and we try everything we can, and it's not always pretty to win. But at the end of the day, no one, because of the way our system is set up, can win everything, all of what they want, all the time. It doesn't work like that. And what happens is you are forced to compromise, either because you are persuaded, maybe you learned something you didn't know. That's what happened with the civil rights movement and white Southerners for the most part. You see an issue in a new light, or you compromise because the debate was set up in such a way that you just can't win, right? And so therefore, even though you're not persuaded, you just go along with it and you get reconciled to the outcome because you had an opportunity to try to win. And so it's a counterintuitive thing, but I think embracing the diversity of America, embracing all the disagreement, all the churn, all the angst, and embracing those goals that everybody has and looking at the places where that happens, that's how we can do great stuff. It's when we try to manage it all and keep it all under control and tell everybody that this is what's going to happen. That doesn't work. Case in point, look at where we are, you know?
Exactly.
And so we can make a mountain out of a molehill, you know, and then by just refusing to let people have a say on what the molehill should look like. And I think time and time again, and I don't want to minimize people's concerns about policy, but compare what we fight about today to what we were fighting about in the '60s. I mean, it's incredible.
It's incredible. And you know, you nailed it. Stop trying to our political leaders, to our establishment leaders, stop trying to manage the outcome. Fight for what you want. But stop trying to game the system and completely manage the outcome. James, I think that's a great place to leave it. James Waldner, senior fellow at the R Street Institute, a lecturer at the great Clemson University, my father's alma mater. I grew up a Danny Ford fan back in the day, and Coach Sweeney's got him back in pretty decent shape this year. James, I see you everywhere. Read you in the New Yorker. Your work is great. You're such a great thought leader, particularly on legislative procedure and how the Congress operates. I even saw you on Morning Journal, and you know why they lit those why they leave those phone lines open to anyone. The first caller you got. Morning Journal, it's always the crank that just wants to rant for 5 minutes, but you handled it very well.
Well, I love it. I love listening, getting calls and, you know, people. I mean, yeah, everybody, you know, it's fun, and it's, and everybody deserves, you know, to have some respect and to listen to what they say, even, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, I think our job is to help people again, to help them understand the world around them and politics, but understand it for themselves. It's not my job to tell people what to think, right? But I can help you. I can, and hopefully can help you to better understand it, so that if there are some, you know, things that aren't aligned with reality, by helping people to understand that reality a little bit better for themselves, again, not based on what I think they should understand, then I think what happens is that people typically become less cranky.
I like it. James Waldner, I could talk to you all day, so I hope you'll come back again. We'll pick this conversation up. But thanks for joining me on 14th and G.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast, brought to you by the lobbying firm of Melman Consulting. For more, just type 14th and G podcast into your favorite search engine, or look for 14th and G wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe.
Beam me up, Mr. Speaker.